Hey everyone, welcome to the 378th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot to talk about this week. We're going to be talking about data privacy. We are also going to talk about the industrial metaverse. Say what? And we've got a lot about Apple because HomeKit is a big topic this week. We're also going to ask you about your Insteon preferences. We've got an overview on ADT's deal with Google and a new Raspberry Pi out there for folks. Plus, we've got a little bit of small news on, from the like super nerd front and one on the smart home front. We're also going to hear from our guest this week, who is Alok Benno. He is the CTO of Parkour SC, and we're going to be talking about supply chain 2.0. That's right. You'll learn about that. And we'll hear from our sponsor, Nordic Semiconductor, talking about their Thingy 53 platform. And now, a message from another one of our sponsors. This week's sponsor is Wirepass. Wirepass is on a mission to set a new standard in the IoT. They believe in infinitely scalable connectivity software that never fails. And they concentrate on large industrial applications. Wirepass thinks connectivity should be affordable, and that is their mission. Wirepass is the future of enterprise IoT. With the recent 5G standard update, they've got a chance to change the IoT in a non-cellular way. You can learn more about their connectivity offering at wirepass.com. That's wirepass.com. All right, Kevin, we're going to start this week off with, last week was kind of a kick in the pants for me. And I feel like we got to talk about it just a little bit before we get into IoT, because this actually is an IoT-related story. So on Friday in the U.S., the Supreme Court basically killed Roe v. Wade, which was a law, actually it was a decision, that said you have the right to privacy and women have the right to abortion. A lot of legal ramifications, a lot of legal nitty-gritty is mostly the right to privacy that it enshrined that then protected the right to have an abortion.
Just to be clear, this was never codified into law.
Right.
Yeah, which is why this was could happen, essentially.
Yes. So this was like really, I don't know what to say. But there has been, since the decision and leading up to the decision because of a draft leak or a leaked draft of the opinion, we've seen a lot of organizations talk about like, hey, don't use period tracker apps. Be careful when you're searching for stuff on getting an abortion in places where there are going to be laws against it because it could be used as evidence against you. And we've also seen, a lot of data around pregnancy. It's actually one of, it's a huge time in anyone's life when you're going to have a kid and you tend to buy a lot of things. There are four reasons that you tend to invest in a smart home and actually having a baby is one of them. So there's a lot of reasons that corporations have historically been interested in collecting data and figuring out if someone's pregnant, because basically it means they're about to spend a lot of money. Also, there are period trackers, but there's also devices like Fitbits and the Apple Watch and things that track your heart rate. These don't actively track if you are pregnant or not, but they can infer pregnancy based on like a rise in resting heart rate. And we've seen that happen a couple times. In Reddit threads, people are like, hey, why is my girlfriend's heart rate rising? And then eventually they come back. They're like, it's because she was pregnant.
Surprise.
So, yeah, exactly. So what we've got is the ability to infer pregnancy from data, from shopping habits, from wearable devices, from actual like women trying to actively conceive. And then we have a corporate interest in figuring out as early as possible when someone is pregnant because it can make you a lot of money. It's really worth it to advertisers. And then you have all of that running into laws that say, hey, if someone is pregnant, we don't want them to get rid of that baby. And if they do get rid of that baby, we want to prosecute them.
And again, just for people overseas, this was a federal court case. It is now back to each individual state to determine their laws on abortion. So this is where it gets kind of murky with data and people traveling across state lines to take a particular action or not. So,
yeah, there's going to be a lot of court cases coming down as people travel across state lines. I'll just be honest. So basically, this is setting up this horrible conflict. It's a legal story and a legal conflict because, like, where I live in Washington State, not only can you get an abortion if you would like one, the governor is also like, hey, you know what? Any company in our state is not going to share data with anybody who's going to try to access location data about someone traveling here to get an abortion.
Right. For prosecution purposes. Yeah. Which is, yeah.
How all that's going to shake out is both a logistical nightmare for any company trying to keep this data and access this data, because now you're going to be like, there's going to be like 50 different fiefdoms where you're like, okay. I mean, you thought it was bad when Europe was like, hey, all of our special data needs to be kept in Europe. Now you're going to have certain data, like location data about people, that is going to be stuck in one state or another. Two, it's also going to create this ginormous legal morass where we fight over, without a federal law, you're going to see basically fights over, hey, can I access this data? No. And that's going to go to the courts. So the bottom line here is this is a freaking mess. And it's not just a privacy story. It's a story that should open our eyes to how much data companies are getting from us and why they want this data. It's to sell us stuff. And they're not going to stop collecting this data. I know people are like, oh, they'll just stop collecting it. They will not. It's too lucrative to them. And there are plenty, there are way more legitimate pregnancies, wanted pregnancies, where the value of this is so high. So the bottom line is, yes, don't use period apps. Yes, follow the Electronic Frontier Foundation's privacy-centric recommendations. But also know that there are way more people interested in tracking this and understanding this than you as an individual can protect against. And so the best solution here is going to be some sort of federal privacy law, some sort of federal protection to abortion. Yeah. And if we don't get these things, then we're going to have years worth of legal cases and lives ruined while we figure this out.
Obviously, I have no such data in that regard to protect, but I am looking at that bigger picture. And in fact, just last week, I believe we talked on the podcast in China how location data was being used from their COVID app.
Yeah, they would turn people into COVID positive on the COVID app. They have a COVID tracking app. They would mark someone positive so they couldn't access public transportation or hotels.
For protests.
Yeah, and go places right. to protest.
So I mean, it keeps coming back. I've said this many times over the years, and I stand by it. Once you lose control over your data, you have no idea who's winning is it and how it's going to be used. So I don't have the answer to that conundrum, obviously, but it's something I keep in mind and something we all need to keep in mind.
Like, well, that's a downer. All right, let's move on to some more IoT-centric stories, our more solely businessy stories. First up, Siemens and NVIDIA.
Wait, let me say it, because I saw this headline and I'm like, this is garbage because it's buzzwords. Siemens and NVIDIA are creating the industrial metaverse. And A, it had industrial, which is not my jam. And B, it had metaverse, which is, I don't even know where to go with that. But having read the actual news release, to me, this is more about something more substantial, such as digital twins.
Yes. Okay. So we've actually talked about this. I feel Siemens has actually done a lot this week. So we'll talk about all of it. But this particular deal with NVIDIA ties Siemens industrial prowess, for lack of a better word. They have lots of sensors. They have lots of partners in this space. And NVIDIA's graphics ability and platforms to create digital twins of factories. And I have long thought of the metaverse for IIoT, industrial IoT, as a way to share complex information and to model things in a way that pulls not just a physics simulation, but actually pulls data in from real life sensors and model that in a way that is coherent for human consumption.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean being able to look at something and say, holy cow, I can see that this is wrong, or I can easily ingest a lot of information into my paltry human eyeballs and brain.
Right. Like this part on the production line or whatever is wearing down. I can see that now. So in advance, I'm going to replace it. Oh, I need instructions on how to replace it. I need a schematic. Oh, I have that because I have my digital twin. Examples like that. Definitely tremendous value.
Yes. That's what this big partnership is around. It is trying to boost that. And it's worth noting that we don't really have a great definition for digital twin. I can talk to a bunch of different people and they will tell me similar things, but a little bit different. And those little differences matter. So when I'm thinking about this particular deal as a digital twin, the important thing to note is you're combining real-time sensor data, so things that are actually happening in the real world, with physics engines and imagery, so NVIDIA's specialty, in using that real-time data to simulate how the real world is behaving in a digital way. And from there, you can do things that we have historically done with models, which is model how something will behave. And this is important because this is going to allow us to treat the real world and bring the speed of computation that we have in terms of experimentation to the real world. And what I mean by that is, like, historically in science, you're like, I have a hypothesis. Let me set up an elaborate experiment to test my hypothesis. You test your hypothesis. And then you're like, oh, I was right or I was wrong. This is better. This is worse. What happens now is by creating these digital twins with real-time inputs, you can model all that virtually very fast at the speed of computation, right? And then you can basically move through these hypotheses really quickly and iterate on them very quickly. And you could do it in a virtual environment before you actually apply it to your real world environment. And that is super powerful. And I liken it to what's happened in, like, biotechnology in the last few years, where we brought computation into biotechnology to do the same thing. And we're getting all kinds of innovation from that. So we're about to see that happen in the real world of factory automation. Yay. So this is part of that theme. Other things that Siemens is doing. Earlier this week, they announced a deal to buy a company called Brightly Software. This is for their building automation, and they're going to bring it into what they call Building X. And Building X is a brand new software as a service launch from them that is going to basically help you make carbon net neutral buildings. And I think of it as, like, Schneider Electric has something called, they call digital eco structure. It's kind of like that is what it looks like. Johnson Controls actually had an announcement last week about their Open Blue concept, which is another building automation. And it's basically creating digital twins of buildings and tying your IT and your OT together. So that's what Siemens has launched, which is called Building X, and the Brightly software acquisition will help them do this.
Yeah, I definitely see all this digital twinning more industrial focus, not consumer focus. Although, I'll be honest, I could see some applications at a consumer space. Like, I just bought a motorcycle and I want to tweak things in the engine. I can do that electronically. I can do that with different parts. Rather than spend the money, you know, $1,500 for a new exhaust just to see what it's going to sound like and what kind of airflow I'm going to get and so on and so forth. If I had a digital twin of my motorcycle and the schematics or particulars of the part that I'm going to use, I could kind of model it, you know, and see, is it worth buying? You know, what am I going to get? You know, I mean, maybe that's a stretch for a consumer example, but I could see a few use cases.
I have some exciting use cases. We'll probably see them come out later this year. I've been talking to some companies doing some cool stuff with the metaverse and digital twins and the smart home, but we're already talking too long about this. So let's move on to our next story, which is all about Apple. Next series of stories. So Apple, actually, we heard a couple weeks ago that Apple was not going to continue letting the iPad be used as a smart home hub.
Right. So, and I never understood why Apple allowed the iPad to be a smart home hub, because it's a mobile-centric device and your smart home hubs typically are stationary, meaning they're in your house, they don't leave your home, and they're always plugged in. And you can't guarantee either of those things with an iPad. That's why the Apple TV and the HomePod speakers are HomeKit hubs. And just so that people understand, you can use Apple HomeKit without a hub, but you can't have automations and other things that have to happen and process on a hub to take place without the hub. So most people probably would have one of these devices. So yes, Apple said at first, nope, the iPad with iOS 16 coming in this fall, it's going to lose its hub functionality. Now they're saying you can continue to use it as a home hub, although I still say you shouldn't. It's not the best device for that. but you won't gain new functionality. And specifically, I think they're talking about the Matter functionality.
Yes, because these iPads don't have Thread. So they won't be able to locally talk to your Thread stuff. They will talk to all your Wi-Fi stuff, which there'll be plenty of. But just to like add a little tweak to this story, we are seeing reports, and they are from Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg, and he's pretty good at this sort of thing. He's saying that Apple is actually going to make another high-end HomePod smart speaker. Remember, they launched one of these back in 2018. It was like $350, and then they were like, woof, I guess not enough people bought them. They then downsized it, and they had an affordable HomePod mini that was only $99, which was the same price as like the Nest Audio and the fourth generation Echo Home Hub. And that's done really well. And this makes sense.
This does make sense depending on the price of the new model. They say it will be closer, at least Gurman says that it will be closer to the original HomePod in terms of size and audio performance. So size-wise, that sucker is probably about, I don't know, 6 times bigger, much heavier magnets inside, much louder sound, much better sound. I mean, it's a nice device. But is it a good value at $350? Probably not. And that's why it didn't sell well and why Apple discontinued it. So my take here is that, yes, they're going to get back into the larger speaker market, hopefully with a lower price. If they've learned their lesson, I would hope that would be it. I hope that they add something more than just saying, yes, this too will be a HomeKit hub, because I'm sure it will be. Maybe some extra radios, maybe some ultra wideband functionality, something. Again, keep that price low, but you know, just making a bigger speaker that's also a HomeKit hub.
Maybe they could add like Wi-Fi motion detection, so then it becomes a sensor in your home.
Right.
But we'll see what happens.
Right. I still think that they lack a true smart display option, although they're bringing smart display features and experience to the Mac, to Apple TV. Even to the tablets to a point, but...
Well, and they've done some things that are interesting with the HomePod mini and ultra wideband. If you have an iPhone and you ask questions, it'll send things to your phone. And also you can, like, when your phone gets near something, it can transfer, like, audio files over. So those are... I know it's not quite the same as an always-on tablet that, like, anyone in your house can use, but it is kind of an interesting option to think about. Maybe you just carry your always-on tablet with you in the form of your phone.
Maybe.
All right. You also have been experimenting for the last year and a half with HomeKit, and you wrote us a lovely bit on how to. I don't want you to go into everything, but I would love for you. I was like, there's a lot. We'll link to it in the show notes. It was in last week's newsletter. But why don't you just give us some kind of high-level ideas and advice?
Yeah, I tended to focus more on automation, meaning you would need a HomeKit hub. So it kind of ties into this news. And I should also say, even if you don't use HomeKit, I recommend reading this article because a lot of the framework applies to all of the smart home ecosystems. Like, you need to be smart when you're actually naming your rooms and your devices, for example. You want consistency throughout the house that the whole family agrees upon, which we actually had like a half hour debate over whether to call a living room the living room or the family room, you know? So you need to get your family on board to get the full value out of this. Also, keep in mind that as these platforms expand in functionality, you'll find new ways to automate things. And I say that because the most recent home app and some of the newest devices, in fact, it was the Ecobee Smart Thermostat Premium, it exposed new sensors that I didn't even know I could use for automations as trigger events. So, you know, when you're setting up automations, don't be afraid to think outside the box and don't just create the automation in your head and then just do it as you think it should be done on your phone or whatever when you set it up. Look around because there's a lot of different options that you may not even be aware of. So, I mean, that's the gist of the article. There's obviously a lot more to it, but those are the key points that I think, and many do apply to all the platforms.
Yes. And I think it's also, you love HomeKit. And I, after seeing this, I'm like, oh, I wish I were the one testing HomeKit.
I feel bad because I feel like many people say he's the HomeKit fanboy. But look, the honest truth is I've tried, I'd say, just about every major platform and even some of the minor ones. And while all of them have good qualities, the one that works consistently reliably, quickly, and simply for me is HomeKit. If you don't have an iPhone, okay, I get it. You know, I'm not saying everybody should get an iPhone and go HomeKit.
You totally are, though. But you tell me this all the time.
No, just you. Just you. Not everybody. Just Stacy.
All right. Let's do an update on Insteon. And I'm sorry, I should have done this last week, but I didn't. So we've talked about Insteon, how in mid-April it shut down without telling anybody. And everyone's like, what just happened? And then it came back again without telling anybody. And now the folks at Insteon have offered subscriptions. So now if you basically... We said this was going to happen. You can't run a cloud-based business without having some way to constantly pay for cloud costs associated with that business. So now you can basically pay $39.95 for a year's access. So that's a one-year access plan. Or you can pay $69.95 or $70 for the two-year plan. And I guess, Kevin, used to use Insteon as part of your, I've used everything.
I did use Insteon all the way back in 2010, but at that time, it was all local. There was no cloud service. So I had it basically an Insteon server. I know they're still around. A lot of people still use them because they just want local control. This product, this access is not for them. It's for people who have the Insteon hubs that do connect to the cloud to keep that hub alive and get information from the internet and remote access and such. Yeah, I mean, if you have Insteon and your hub is back on and you don't want to change, even though we've given options, you think Insteon is the best option for you, which is perfectly valid, a valid reason to stick with it, you can, for $40, keep that hub alive with the cloud service. I don't think it's a terrible deal. I mean, I know it's not what people are used to because they weren't paying before.
Yeah, and you don't have to pay if you don't want the integration with Matomei or Google or...
Or push notifications or other things that the cloud enables. Yeah, you can stay local and you're good. Not pay.
Yeah. But there you go. And if you do that, presumably we can ensure the future of Insteon going forward and maybe their communication will be better for their paying customers. Okay. So almost 2 years ago, Google said that they would buy a 6.6% stake in alarm company ADT for $450 million. And now an article in Bloomberg takes a look at how that partnership is going. And I was actually a little surprised by this story. One, y'all, it's a really good story. It's well written. It's not super information dense, but it's context dense, which I appreciate. And the whole point is like ADT, which for years just resold other people's hardware and they had a lot of false alarms. Most people kind of hated them. The alarm business was like pretty stagnant. They said, hey, we should get into the smart home. They tried. They did a deal with Zonoff to like make a platform. It didn't work. So they did this deal with Google. And it is clear that this deal with Google means a lot to ADT. And what they do is they resell Google hardware along with some other hardware that they still get from third-party vendors. And they just basically have installers install it and they brand it under the ADT brand. Google, on the other hand, they did an app for ADT. They obviously provide some of their hardware for them. But other than that, it seems like it's a much bigger deal for ADT than it is for Google. But I think Google gets not only to sell their hardware, they get access to all of the installers, which in the smart home is a big deal. It is like people are lazy. They do not want to install all this stuff. And when they do install it, they oftentimes do it wrong. So having a person come in and do it for you is actually a big value.
And not just the installation, but just setting things up, maybe the way you might want. Some basic automations or routines. People, they put things in their house and they're like, okay, now what can I do with it? Whereas when you have a professional installation, you may have access to, you know, some suggested. Most of our customers do this. They want notifications when there's a car in the driveway from that camera. Would you like me to set that up? You know?
Yeah. And as perspective, Vivint, which is a competitor to ADT, is doing a lot of that work on their own. But ADT is like, hello, Google. And Google's didn't do it for them. So I think this is noteworthy. It also shows like one of the things that I think was fun in here is this idea that, hey, ADT had like 80% recurring revenue. Like people just kept signing up and paying for their security, right? And that really led them to a place where they're like, eh, we don't have to do anything. They were stagnant. And that's why they struggled when we did this transition to smart homes. And I don't think that's bad. It also shows people are saying, hey, Google doesn't get a lot out of this. I say they get the installer networks, but they also get the data. This is many, like a lot of the ADT homeowners are older. They're not technically savvy. They're getting a lot more data from people who are not self-selecting into the smart home, which I think is worth noting.
Right. It's probably a large segment of geographic, but demographic data that they weren't otherwise getting as much of.
Yes. So read that article. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. All right. Guess what? There's a new Raspberry Pi Pico out. If you remember, the Pico was this tiny little microcontroller that cost $4 and you could even buy it on a reel. I mean, just crazy. It was designed for industrial people, for folks building lots of things, and it's pretty sweet. Historically, the Pi has been a much fatter computer with like a ARM Cortex class.
Yeah, like almost like a smartphone chip.
Yeah, Cortex A class. Sorry. I was like, what classes? Where am I? Not an M class. So the Pico now comes in wireless with 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi. So this is the Pi Pico W. It costs $6. And now you can take your microcontroller and get it onto the internet. Woo!
Yeah. And just to clarify, because we mentioned the regular Raspberry Pi, when we say microcontroller, this is an ARM Cortex M0 Plus microprocessor. 133 megahertz, which actually still is faster than my 486 computer that I bought in, I don't know, 1996.
Aw, I built a 486 computer with my dad.
Did it have a turbo button?
No.
I had a 386 with a turbo. I go from 16 to 25 megahertz, baby.
Woo! Vroom. Anyway, the point is, this device is now available to buy if you're like going to test things out or if you want to buy a whole bunch. I was talking to somebody at the Raspberry Pi Trading Co. That's the organization that actually sells the Pis. The foundation is the one that is working on all the charitable, like teach kids how to compute kind of thing. And basically, last week at Embedded World, they gave away 25,000 Raspberry Pi Picos to attendees, which is insane. And they're basically getting on track to be able to ship 1 million Raspberry Pi Picos within a week's lead time, which is crazy, which means they're designing their own chips and now they're going to be able to make them available to people in large amounts, which is pretty cool because we've talked about how the supply chain issues and the chip shortage have really kind of put a damper on innovation because sometimes all these cool dev kits out there, you can't get access to them.
Yeah. I also like that they stated this will remain in production until at least January 2028. So if you're prototyping, building devices off this, you know you've got some stability in terms of the hardware.
That's really important for IoT.
Yep.
Okay. Let's move to some short news stories because we've been talking for a while. All right. Two worth noting. One from IEEE Spectrum. This is just awesome research. So, researchers at the Tokyo Institute of Technology, they've basically developed a transceiver that can send and receive data while also receiving power. That is crazy. Usually you have to, when you're dealing with like RF and frequencies, they interfere with each other as they're coming and going. So that's tough. And then getting the power at the same time as sending and receiving data, it cancels each other out. So this is pretty awesome. This means that they'd be able to like power up while they're getting their data. And thus, anytime you're sending data, you're generating power, or receiving data, you're generating power, which means you don't need batteries. This is obviously still in the research phase. We'll just put that in there.
Yeah, they're only up to creating like 1 milliwatt of power at this point. But it's neat how they do it because they're basically beamforming from the small antennas at different angles to kind of work around that canceling out issue.
Yeah, pretty cool. Check it out. The future is coming. It's just, you know, taking a while, as it always does. Okay. And finally, Kevin, why don't you tell us about this?
I am so not happy about this one, but I will share it with a smile. If you have a Nest doorbell, you've got special ringtones available to you for July 4th, which is Independence Day here in the US. You can have God Bless America. You can have the Star Spangled Banner. Those I have no problem with. It's the third tone, fireworks. And I say that because I have a pet, and anybody who has a pet probably has dealt with fireworks around the 4th of July and having, well, if your pet is anything like mine, the dog hears fireworks, starts shaking uncontrollably, and goes and hides behind a toilet bowl. So
mine hides under the bed.
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say about that.
But yes.
Yeah, just use God Bless America or the Star Spangled Banner.
Or, you know, you don't have to use any. But this, you don't use it at all. That's right. Everybody rolls out special holiday-themed ringtones. All right. That concludes this segment of the show, but stay tuned because we're about to enter the Internet of Things podcast hotline. Dun, 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 dun. This is the segment of the show where we answer your questions. And to get us to answer them, you should give us a call at 512-623-7424. And we might answer your question on the show. And you will also be entered to win this month's prize. And by the way, let's see, as you're hearing this, you have like 12 hours left until midnight on June 30th Eastern time to call us and enter to win a... Every week we do this, I'm like, what do I call this thing? It's a hose monitor?
The water controller.
The water controller. You plug your hose into this and then you have internet connectivity, like basically controls your hose. So you can schedule things with your hose. This is great for people who don't have like sprinkler systems. This is for people like me who just run a hose in the garden in the summer.
We just planted grass seed and we're supposed to water it every night and we don't. So this would be perfect for that.
Yeah, so we'll give you an Eve Aqua, which is HomeKit compatible. Eventually, we'll probably be Matter compatible. But if you're not down for that, we can also send you a Orbit Beehive. We've played with both. They're lovely. Okay, so call us and you'll be entered to win. If you do it before the 30th, you know what you're going to win. And this week's caller is Drew. Let's hear it.
Hey, guys. My name is Drew. I'm from Florida. I'm calling with a question about hot water heater, electric hot water heater. And I want to know if you guys have any advice for any kind of smart switches for an electric hot water heater. We're not home a lot, so we find ourselves turning the hot water heater on and off manually. But I was looking for a way to automate this. So if you guys have any ideas, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, Drew. I am doing exactly what you want to be doing, and I'm doing it with a device called the Aquanta. This is a $149 device that I've had on my water heater for like a year. I don't know. It's been a while. Mm-hmm. And I can turn it on, turn it off. But the cool thing is it actually, I don't have to do any of that because it actually tracks my usage and tries to turn the temperature down. It basically plays, it walks the line between lowering my energy cost by turning the heat down when it can and making sure I have enough hot water to do what I want to do.
It's kind of like a smart thermostat with learning capabilities only for your water heater.
Yeah. And it does a great job. I've never not had hot water when I've wanted it. Mm-hmm. And I have a teenager and they use a lot of water. And I have a hot tub that actually heats the water for me. So that's irrelevant. Never mind. Ignore that. Okay. So the Aquanta is a really good option for electric or gas heaters, and you can check that out. But there are other options. You can also buy a brand new water heater. Almost sure. All brand new water heaters.
Just go right out ahead and replace it.
That may not be a great option. But the major water heater brands like Kenmore, Rheem, they have modules that you can use to attach to the water heater, and they will perform similar functionality.
The thing is with those, the modules are brand specific. So you're not going to, if you have an old Kenmore water heater, you're not going to go out and get the Rheem module for Wi-Fi. It's just not going to work. So you're kind of limited to the brand that you have, but it's, you know.
It's cheaper too. They're like, what, between 60 and like 80 bucks?
Yeah, they're typically not as expensive. That's correct. You know, I think the one that you have, because it can work with any water heater, you have to hardwire it, I presume, you're going to pay a little bit more for that flexibility.
And then there's finally a company called PowerX. I haven't tried this one, but this is a good option if it's more expensive, but this is a good option for tankless water heaters. And broadly speaking, the installation for these is they have a sensor for hot and for cold, and you zip tie those sensors to the outside of a pipe. And then there is a computing and connectivity element to it that you hardwire into the electricity of your water heater. So you are going to have to turn your power off. There's going to be a little bit of wiring. It's not hard.
You can do it.
You can totally do it. I will say that I struggled a little bit when I was doing it because I've got 12 gauge wire, which is freaking fat and hard. But, and I've got tiny little sad fingers with no muscles on them. like, ah, but you can do it. It's not that painful. And it took me about probably 15, 20 minutes. And yeah, it works. And a lot of these come with leak sensors that just kind of drape down into the thing. So if your water heater starts like leaking, it will tell you. So they're kind of multifunctional. I like it. It's a good product. So PowerX is the brand that also competes with Aquanta and will also work on tankless, which the Aquanta does not.
And I presume that you end up getting like a mobile app that you can remotely turn off the water heater. So like if you go on vacation, for example, the system may not learn that for a couple of days, but you can kind of preempt it by just shutting off remotely.
Yeah, you can put it in vacation mode. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to do that, eventually it'll figure out you're on vacation.
Yep.
But yeah, they're really handy.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. All right. So remember, if you would like us to answer your questions, give us a call at 512-623-7424, and you will be entered to win an Eve Aqua or the Orbit Beehive hose thing. I'm not going to do it. And that concludes this segment of the show, but stay tuned for our guest, Alok Benno, who is the CTO of Parkour SC, which we're going to talk about Supply Chain 2.0. They're basically creating digital twins for the supply chain. We'll talk about what that means, why they got out of making hardware, and an acquisition that that company just made. But first, let's hear a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Nordic Semiconductor. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is Nordic Semiconductor. And I have Bjorn Spokeli, who is with Nordic Semiconductor, here with us today. So first, could you please tell us a little bit about Nordic?
Sure, Stacey. Nordic Semiconductor, we specialize in wireless technology that powers the Internet of Things. We were established back in 1983, and we have award-winning Bluetooth Low Energy solutions that have made us the global market leader in that particular market. We've also become an emerging leader in low-power cellular IoT and Wi-Fi. And our high-performance, easy-to-design solutions are used by world-leading brands within smart home, healthcare, asset tracking, gaming, sports and fitness, industrial automation, and the list really goes on.
Nordic has just released a brand new multi-protocol IoT prototyping platform. This is the Nordic Thingy 53. I'm really excited about it. So can you tell us what is interesting about the Thingy 53 and what you can actually do with it?
Yeah, so the heart of the Thingy 53 is our dual-core NF53 SoC, which gives the Thingy 53 plenty of processing power and memory to run advanced applications like machine learning models. And in addition, we've added the NF-21540 front-end module for extended range and the NPM 1100 PMIC for power delivery and battery charging. So the Thingy 53 is, in fact, a complete Nordic solution. The Thingy 53's sensor portfolio allows it to measure temperature, humidity, pressure, motion, magnetic fields, and light. And we've also added a PDM microphone for audio capture, and you can even wake the entire system up just using its wake on sound functionality. So I would actually turn your last question around and ask what you can't do with the Thingy 53.
Well, who can start using the Thingy? Is it for anyone to try out? Do you need to be an engineer?
Ease of use has been one of the main priorities for the Thingy 53, and we really want it to be used by engineers and non-engineers alike to put their concepts and ideas into practice. We've therefore partnered with Edge Impulse to have out-of-the-box machine learning capabilities on the Thingy 53 using the NRF Edge Impulse app. And I would actually argue that embedded machine learning has never been as easy as it is on the Thingy 53. We've also developed the NRF Programmer app, which acts as an embedded app store for the different applications that we have developed for the Thingy 53. You simply select the sample you want to try out and then update the firmware over Bluetooth Low Energy at the press of a button.
Sweet. So how can I get started if I want to try this out and play with the Thingy 53?
I would start by going to nordicsme.com/Thingy53. From there, you can access all the documentation as well as the Getting Started guide. The guide shows you how to connect to the Thingy 53 using the NRF Edge Impulse app and how to run your first machine learning model. After that, I would download the NRF Programmer app and then test out all the different samples that we have for the Thingy 53. And then last but not least, I would sign up for our upcoming webinar about the Thingy 53 on July 6th on nordicsme.com/webinar.
Hey Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham. And today's guest is Alok Beno, who is the CTO of Parkour SC. Hello, Alok. How are you doing?
Hi, Stacey. Very nice to talk to you.
Excellent. So we have a lot to talk about. We're going to be talking about making digital twins for the supply chain. We're going to be talking about a brand transition for the company and a tiny little acquisition. So let's get started by first giving people a sense of what the heck is Parkour SC?
Parkour SC is a supply chain platform. We picked the name Parkour because we wanted to attach ourselves more to the what we refer to as the illities of supply chain. So a lot of modern supply chains, as they're dealing with disruptions, are starting to redefine themselves. Some people call it digital transformation. Some people call it supply chain 2.0 or the next generation of supply chain, etc. But in doing so, and then thinking through what is next for supply chain, they're looking at a lot of these characteristics. It needs to be more resilient, needs to be more reliable, it needs to be agile. The common thread that we saw through all of these, what we refer to as illities, was we also saw these same qualities manifested in the sport of parkour. So that whole concept resonated with us a lot.
I just thought it was because parkour is a pretty freaking cool sport, but my bad. So you mentioned the concept of supply chain 2.0, and I'm really curious what all that entails, because I think of, like, when I think about modernizing the supply chain, I'm like, oh, look, we can stick a tag on things or a tracker on everything and see where it is in the supply chain. But I think you're probably talking about something a little bit more involved.
That's right. So you're not wrong in terms of how a lot of the thinking on the next generation of supply chain originated. It originated around what you now refer to as visibility solutions. Traditionally, the way that the data got collected, the way information moved in a supply chain was in a lot of silos, since by definition, it is a cross-organizational, cross-functional kind of an operation where there's many different entities in your supply chain that need to come together to make sure that the product gets from through the whole process of source, make, build, deliver, etc. So that whole process got a shot in the arm with the sensorization of the entire chain, and it resulted in better visibility. And that was the starting point for this next generation thinking. But over the past few years, we've evolved much further than that. Visibility and sensorization has served as an interesting first step for a lot of enterprises. And as they've started to see value in some of what we refer to as dot on the map kind of solutions, they've now started to get more demanding of what they expect from those kinds of solutions, whether it is more intelligence around that information, better insights, or whether it is getting into more automation in terms of automation flow, etc. But all leading to sort of better reliability in the supply chain, better agility in being able to make decisions and being able to respond to incidents and events, of which there is no shortage, given the fact that geopolitical issues, we're seeing disruptions due to COVID. And so all of these things are kind of raising the bar on the expectations of what is required off of supply chain practitioners.
Okay, so we're moving from being a dot on the map. You can see where something is. You've mentioned trying to figure out, hey, what's going to cause the delays? How do we route around it? So can you give me some of the specific use cases your customers are using your platform for as part of this supply chain 2.0?
Sure. So let's take an example of a package. Let's take an example specifically of sort of vaccines moving in packages. So these products require some level of sort of temperature control. You have to make sure that temperature stays within some sort of strict boundaries. The packages, the boxes that are designed to transport these products are not average sort of corrugated box that you get from Amazon in the mail, but it has some sort of special characteristics around sort of thermal insulation and sort of they're designed to transport certain kinds of things. And there's different sizes. They come in different insulation materials and thicknesses, etc. So you can, depending upon your needs, how much time it's going to take to transport, etc., you get to pick the right kind of box. Usually what happens is when shippers make decisions on these packages, They'll put their product in packages and ship it. They make those decisions based on certain parameters or criteria. What we allow with the sensorization of these boxes is actually to track the actual performance of the product or the package, which serves two purposes. One is if the temperature or the thermal characteristics of the product start to deviate off the bounds during transport, then you have the ability to take corrective action. The other is when you get to the end of the journey, you have an accurate log of the temperature, humidity characteristics of the journey, which is, can then be used from a compliance and a regulation perspective. On the first part, which is being able to take corrective action in case a package gets left in the sun for a period of time or it misses a flight or a connection, you now know that it may not get to the destination within the temperature bounds, and then you can take some corrective action. There is a reactive way of doing it, and then there is a predictive way of doing it. The reactive way is to send out notifications that temperature is out of bounds, in which case it may be too late by the time you have the ability to take any action. And the predictive way of doing it is actually to run a predictive model in real time. As you're getting this information from the sensors, there could be temperature humidity sensors, and then being able to predict how much thermal charge you have left on that box and how does that correlate to the expected time of arrival if it changes over a period of time. And then you have a little more lead time to make decisions on what to do with that package or a box before it gets into trouble.
So then I have to ask, based on using AI or just using statistics, how do you predict what feels unpredictable? Because right now, when we talk about the supply chain, it feels like many of the challenges, they do seem kind of unpredictable just because consumer behavior is changing. Maybe a war broke out. Those sorts of things.
I mean, interestingly, come from a background where this is not considered as much wizardry as it might seem like to some people. I built sort of fraud models and risk models in financial services for a good part of my career. So I'm fairly comfortable with being able to predict and being able to measure the accuracy of the prediction, which is how you hold yourselves accountable. And quite honestly, we're not talking about these black swan events like, you're right. There's no way to predict an evergreen war in Ukraine or those kinds of things. You can call them black swan events. But what you can do a better job at doing is how you respond to these events. Are you set up in a nimble enough way to be able to respond with some level of confidence? So being able to have your strategies in place so that you are able to take corrective action should things change is where predictions and infrastructure like the ones that we put into places become very, very useful. So while you're not predicting these political events or the physical things that happen around the world, you are predicting the outcome of making changes to lanes, routes, congestions in certain places, etc., which are a byproduct of these large events. So where predictions and math and algorithms, etc., help you is more at one level below these significant events.
And how can technology help once you're trying to strategize around these disruptions? I believe that's where digital twins may or may not come into play.
Yeah, no. So digital twin is the first step in the journey. It's a step that allows you to create a digital representation of your supply chain. And the way we think about it and talk about it different from how the word is normally thrown around in the common vernacular is when we talk about digital twins, we are talking about it not just from a point of view of being able to model properties and static parameters of various elements of your supply chain. And by various elements, I mean things like factories and locations and warehouses and distribution centers and carriers and packages and containers and products, but also being able to attribute behavior at the entity level to each of these things. And that leads to a very, very powerful set of capabilities that can then be used to model some very, very sophisticated behavioral capabilities. We call it sort of automating your standard operating procedures. So anecdotally, people have told us that literally 80% of the things that are done in response to challenges, et cetera, are automatable. With sort of limited resources in a supply chain organization, they want to focus those limited resources on their most important products or lanes or routes or part of the business, because about 20% of their products could be generating 80% of revenue or 80% of margins. So the remaining stuff, which can create a lot of noise in the system and distract them from paying attention to the most important things, are things that we can potentially automate through prescriptive rules or through predictive algorithms. They're all driven by real-time signals, and signals can be acquired from many different sources. They can be acquired from sensors, or they can be acquired from sort of non-sensory sources, but they all attach to the digital twin, which is where we trigger a lot of these sort of behavioral automation workflows, et cetera.
So to create these digital twins, we're looking at integrating into your platform things like, hey, some trackers out there, probably some, I'm trying to think of the bill of lading automations or software that's out there already, but like those kind of things. What else gets integrated in to create this digital twin?
Right. So there's two parts to it. The first part of creating the digital twin is the static representation of the digital twin. So it's defining all of your entities and all the behaviors in the entities, et cetera. The second part is what you're referring to, which is the signals that then get attached to various points in the network or the entities in the digital twin. The signals can come from sensory sources, like you said, trackers, or the example that I gave of temperature humidity sensors go through a binding process that are bound to packages or products. But they can also come from RFID tags. They can also come from QR code scans. They can also come from bad jobs that you can run inside of an existing ERP system and feed data into. They can come from various kinds of sort of third-party data sets around weather, traffic, etc. So for us, everything is a signal. So everything kind of gets normalized into a signal, and that signal drives the response of the digital. That's how the system interacts. So once you have a digital twin, once you have signals feeding or driving the behavior on the digital twin, then the digital twin can start responding through either sort of collaborative tools or through automated rules or through predictive capabilities. So there's many different ways the digital twin can respond.
So if I wanted to create a digital twin of my supply chain, how much do my partners need to do? Because obviously I'm pulling in a lot of information. I've got sensing, but there's a lot of other players in a supply chain.
Yeah, you're right. And therein lies the problem, right? So historically, a lot of the solutions in this space have been what I'd call enterprise solutions. Very few provide pan-enterprise capabilities. So an example would be collaboration capabilities across the enterprise, because to get a package through customs in a remote country requires you to work with some local agents that are helping you through that process. How do you interface with them? If you're doing that via email, you're sending them documents, those documents could get lost, that could cause delays. If it's a temperature-sensitive box that then ends up sitting in customs for a couple of days longer than needed or necessary, if it's meat products that are being shipped, the fish could go bad, or many sort of bad things can happen. Those are the kind of things that you don't have very good solutions for in the market, elegant solutions that then allow you to drive some of these sort of collaborative capabilities without having to jump outside of your enterprise product. You could give access to people outside of your enterprise to windows of information or data or workflows that you set up for them. But to get to the other part of your question, where if I can sensorize stuff that are in my control, but I might need signals or data sets that I don't control, input from those, that's where our ability to build out an ecosystem of partners and providers goes a long way in helping our end customers solve those problems. So for instance, we are deeply integrated into a lot of logistics service providers. So we get a lot of signals from them around sort of shipments and movement of product as it gets through their leg of the supply chain. We have deep integrations into packaging companies. We get signals from them. So through these various different sort of pre-integrated sources, we are able to triangulate and put together a much more sort of compelling picture for the end customers. That also happened to be the end customers for the packaging companies. It happened to be the end customers for the logistics providers, etc. So it's very much an ecosystem.
Got it. And I should be clear, all of this is software. None of this is actually hardware or sensing or Murend, right?
That is correct. So our solution is completely a SaaS-based platform, and it's all software. We are fairly signal agnostic, sensor agnostic. The legacy of Cloudleaf going back way back in time was sensors. They built some of their own sensors, but the last three years or so, we moved away from our own hardware and now fairly sort of sensor or signal agnostic.
Why did y'all move away from your own hardware?
It's a different kind of a business and a company. I think it's hard for a company to concentrate on two things at the same time, to build out all of the technology of hardware, as well as build out a lot of the solutioning that's required in the cloud. I did have some experience prior to these startups at a company called Verifone, the CTO there. So we built payment terminals. I'm fairly familiar with how hardware is built and all the challenges associated with that. And I feel that you have your hands full doing one or the other, trying to do both at the same time for a startup our size didn't make much sense. That's why we chose to focus on the SaaS and the solutioning side of things.
The value just wasn't there on the hardware side. And that makes sense. Let's talk about acquisitions. Prior to this, you worked at a company called Kappa, which actually Parkour acquired after you moved over to it. And I would love to hear why that acquisition took place.
Yeah, so several of the things that we've talked about from a digital twin perspective, as well as the intelligence capabilities around the digital twin, were technologies that came as part of this acquisition. I was one of the founders at Copper and spent several years building out the core infrastructure around some of these things. The target market there was slightly different. It was more sort of retail operations, not as much supply chain operations. With the coming of COVID, things were somewhat disruptive from a business perspective for Copper, and Parkour seeing a lot more traction with supply chain solutions. And I was in an interesting position to be able to connect the dots and translate the value of what had been created in Copper with regards to the intelligence and the automation capabilities and apply that to the solutions that we were creating at Parkour. And the net result is this new platform that we've just launched. And it brings into play all of the elements of the digital twin and backs it up with a behavioral engine that allows us to encode the predictive and the prescriptive capabilities that I discussed in the context of the digital twin.
Excellent. All right. We've come full circles. I appreciate you talking to me about this, Ola. And thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
Thank you, Stacey. Appreciate it.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.